The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Exchange Live. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished small and mid-cap fund manager Brendan Gulston of Gresham House. So welcome, Brendan.
Thanks, Paul. Good to chat again. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, we certainly need your expertise. We've had a ton of volatility of late, as you know, not least the sort of the unwinding of the yen carry trade about a month ago. We've had the weakening US economy, as evidenced by sort of falling commodity and oil prices. And then more recently, we've had the uninverting of the US yield curve as well. But before we sort of run through your view of the sort of the markets going forward, I don't suppose you could just quickly remind the audience what kind of investor you are, what kind of stocks you like.
Yeah, so we only focus on the UK. So we're UK only, long only asset managers, UK equities. We have a kind of, I suppose what sort of differentiates us a bit is our heritage from having been part of a private equity firm. So we think about returns in a kind of, and risk in a private equity type mindset. So naturally we're very kind of fundamentals, quality driven type of investors, take a long term time horizon. We try and, we're not value investors, but we try and, valuation is a big discipline for us. And we've got some small cap heritage. You know, there's a huge opportunity at that end of the spectrum, but we do, as you say, we do run strategies kind of up to the larger cap end as well for one of our funds. So yeah, so it's a quality focused fundamentals type investors. All of our portfolios are relatively concentrated. So they're all sort of 40 to 50 holdings, apart from one of our funds is more concentrated than that. So it's about 15 to 20 holdings. So I guess the overarching theme there is we're sort of conviction investors rather than kind of diversifying return sources away. So that's definitely a key theme for us.
We've got some lovely big global trends in your portfolio. We've got some stocks to run through, things like AI, machine learning, healthcare, data analytics and stuff like that. So we've got through those. If anybody wants to ask Brendan a question, then put it into the chat bot and I will read them out. But before we get there, just top level, we've obviously had some sort of correction of late on sort of small caps, et cetera, which I know is your sort of sweet spot. What's your sort of view for UK small caps going forward over the next sort of 4 months or even to the next year or so?
Yeah, look, I think we try to not get too caught up in the shorter term movements. You know, the nature of this game is that there's markets move around all the time. They respond to short-term sentiment changes and short-term events. So I think that's in part and parcel of the environment we operate in. I think generally, one of the key aspects around this is the sort of political backdrop, which is quite a polarized topic. And we don't take a sort of view on that necessarily, but I think that generally the political environment's probably become more favorable since the election. And there are concerns around the budget and tax, et cetera. But I think overall, looking forward, we've gone from a situation, irrespective of your view on government, probably gone from a situation where we actually have a bit more stability, we have a strong majority, more of a clear mandate, there's less volatility. So companies can sort of plan and invest. And I think notwithstanding any other sort of issues that there are around politics and government, that as a base platform is probably better long term for investment, probably better long term for the UK stock market. So I think that is probably, in our view, I think that's that is more favourable. I think the economic environment generally, again, notwithstanding your opening comments about some of the sort of regression, perhaps in some of the figures, again, it's probably short term, but I think if you look at the macro picture for us, the direction of travel is improving, right? So, inflation is coming down or has come down, interest rates marginally down, GDP is sort of flat to actually up. And if you look at the first half of 2024, those three metrics are all outperforming versus Europe and the US. Other economic indicators, corporate and consumer balance sheets, labor market data, business investment, that those are, again, all on an improving trajectory. So it's probably early days, but I think, again, that's a, you know, that's a, probably a marginal positive for us. I think the other point is then that, you know, where, what kind of, what's priced in and what, where are we coming from in terms of history? And, you know, we are coming from a very negative backdrop in terms of, you know, the paradigm shift in the operating environment and interest rates, but also the sentiment towards the UK, you know, over 3 years in terms of consecutive months of redemptions out of UK equities. That, you know, so we don't need suddenly GDP to shoot up to 8% for things to make an impact. You know, we need marginal gains, or perhaps even just, you know, a stop in redemptions in UK equities, just net neutral flows. You know, we think that that can make a huge impact on the sort of UK stock market, because the way that the UK stock market is priced is, you know, it's the discounts are, you know, they're enormous versus history, versus other developed markets, versus the private world, and then in the small cap to large cap discount, again, there's another discount. So you're getting, you know, four sets of discounts, and it's not going to take much to change that. And sort of things have been changing a bit. So I think outlook is probably more positive, huge opportunity in the UK from a valuation perspective. And as you said earlier, you know, the UK is a great market in terms of finding businesses that are really exciting, that are playing into structural themes. You know, people play Nvidia and some of these AI things. We've got companies that are, you know, benefiting from that changing ecosystem, but you can buy on like 6 or 7 times EBITDA, not about 70 times revenue or whatever. So I think there's a huge opportunity set as well that's been slightly overlooked.
Yeah, no, I would totally agree. And we're going to run through some of those stocks. Ones are actually utilizing AI really beneficially. And they also got the picks and shovels, guys. But we've got a couple of questions coming in. First one was overnight. We had from Michael T and also from Gulan just this morning, asking you, Brendan, on your latest thoughts of Diaceutics, which is basically a healthcare IT services, data services provider that I think aggregates information of test diagnostic data from labs around the world and enables large biopharma companies then to launch their new biotech, and particularly the precision medicine, personalized medicine drugs, to a more sort of like targeted, personalized population. I don't want to give you your latest thoughts on that, because I know they've been investing quite heavily of late. They're reaching sort of profitability, and it looks as though the growth is now starting to really accelerate. So what's your views?
Yeah, look, this is a brilliant business. We've backed it since the IPO. I think the thing that we thought was really exciting at the start was, the as you allude to, the market opportunity. So we had quite a fundamental belief that the way that you would diagnose and treat certain therapeutic indications would shift towards being personalized, towards being much more data driven, and that certain disease sets would almost become, you know, would be split out into smaller diseases because of that targeted sort of therapy mentality. So oncology is a great example. You know, that used to be, people used to think about cancer being one thing, and then you split it into the different types of cancer, and then you look at the biomarkers, and you split, you know, lung cancer into, again, a subset of cancers. And so we saw that as being a kind of game changer in the healthcare and pharmaceutical industry. And the way that the drug companies were changing was they're isolating specific proteins that cause, you know, that cause a certain disease to progress. And they're creating very sort of targeted therapies that can be really effective in patients. So what Diaceutics was doing in quite a clever way, but not as clever a way as it's doing now, was essentially amassing a data set of patients who have tested for various diseases, and then sort of packaging those up, combining it with other data from insurance providers, and then sort of selling it to pharmaceutical companies and saying, you know, if you're about to launch a drug that is targeting this type of test or diagnostic, only 20% of the people who've actually got this this specific disease are testing for it. So you need to go and get them to test more, and then you can 5x your revenue opportunity. And that's essentially the premise. So you've got a market that's completely shifting towards that in terms of the drug companies. You've then got this kind of asymmetry between what they know about who's testing, because people go and get tested in, you know, small labs, you know, in small sort of places across the world, and no one's really connecting it properly. What the business has done over the last sort of 3 or 4 years is basically kind of shift that whole business from being a kind of consulting services focused model to being a data platform, which now uses software and uses AI to essentially provide a real-time view, a daily. So they've got a product which can tell pharmaceutical company daily, you've had another 100 patients test positive, and this is where they're located, and these are the physicians, and this is how you access them. And you know, the business has been shifting its business model towards this platform-based sort of data sale, which is now, I think it's over half of the revenue, and it's on a trajectory to be, you know, well into the majority. The margins are over 80% gross margin. The data is a proper kind of proprietary data set. It's extremely powerful. I mean, just imagine if you're running a pharmaceutical company and you give your sales team that tool, if you can just check daily how many more patients, and this is the physician, you can almost automate someone to just a chat bot to just call up the physician and tell them that, you know, we've got a product that can help their patient. So it's such a compelling value proposition. And, you know, that's why the business is growing so strongly in revenue terms. I think we're at quite an exciting inflection point, because, as you say, the business has been investing quite heavily into the platform, but that's coming to an end fairly soon. The operational leverage is significant, and you're going to see this business pivot into proper cash generation mode. It's got net cash on the balance sheet. So I think, you know, the next couple of years can be pretty exciting. And that, you know, that data set and that platform is really quite, it's very unique.
Yeah. I mean, if you've got a biotech company and its treatment is sort of like a personalized medicine or in rare disease, then they might be charging £100,000 a year on a sort of chronic condition, or just as a treatment, or even I've heard of $1 million on some of the rare diseases. So the economics work perfectly. Have they got any competitors in this at all? Any major, any CROs that, you know, contract research organizations which do something similar?
Yeah, I think, I mean, IQVIA will do something similar. Some of the larger CROs definitely have, you know, data businesses within them that do something similar. I think but what they haven't done is this has taken over a decade, you know, in terms of going to these research labs who actually do the tests and process. You know, some of the labs don't actually know how to do certain tests. So a lot of the hard yards here has been not only building a data platform, but actually partnering with these labs, finding a reciprocal model, which means you don't have to pay them loads of money to start testing. But then there's a technical element around this is how you test for this new type of small cell lung cancer, because you've got to do it slightly differently. And that's taken a long time. And that network of labs is, you know, that's a huge bit of IP, because that obviously makes the strength of your signal much stronger, because you can capture more data points. So I think that's perhaps something that's been slightly missed by some of the bigger players who derive a huge amount of revenue from doing CRO services from some of the massive pharma companies. So it's sort of carved out a bit of its own niche. But yes, I'd say some of the CROs are doing this and competing in some way.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's just switch sectors, but stay on the sort of the data AI theme. Let's go to NetCall, which is a highly profitable sort of software business that originally started some time ago, I think, as a sort of like a software platform for call centers, but has branched out now and really concentrating on delivering sort of intelligent automation to its sort of customer set. That's sort of the local governments, it's sort of the telco providers, big sort of call center operators, etc. Give us your latest view on this one, because what seems to be absolutely really interesting is on the pricing, because Nvidia, obviously the darling of all AI, trades at about 15 to 20 times sales And this one trades at less than 3x sales. So, and it's profitable and cash generative. Anyway, give what you like is for your net call.
Yeah, look, this is, there's a few AI buzzwords in there, automation. And but look, this business has pivoted significantly, I would say, over the last, 6-7 years. You used to do sort of call center software. And it's broadened its product to be kind of customer engagement software, but really, the process automation and the kind of digitization in large businesses. So it's enterprise software, and it's got a big presence in healthcare and public services. And it is playing. I don't want to over egg it and say this is like a massive AI play, but it's playing that kind of, do those types of customers need to embrace sort of chatbots or embrace kind of machine learning algorithms which drive down, improve their operating model and drive down costs and drive efficiencies? Absolutely. And what this business has done really well through, a clear strategy and through some acquisitions is to expand their capability into being able to provide these tools through things like low-code software development, but, through a bunch of other sort of intelligent automation businesses that they've acquired. Alongside that, the business model has transitioned towards, from a kind of on-premise sale towards a SaaS business. And so now over 75% of the revenues are recurring. So most of them come from their kind of cloud subscription services, which is, 75% recurring. And, one of the key stats, which is quite encouraging as well, is around the net retention rate for their existing customers. So I think it's either 111% or it's 119%, whether you include one of the big customers renewing. So, even if you take the lower number, they're growing by 11% without adding any new customers, just from their existing customer base. And that's in a high margin software business, that's a great stat.
For investors, I think the net retention or revenue retention basically is a good indicator of upselling, isn't it? It's basically increasing the share of wallet of your existing client, selling more to them. So
the net change in revenue from your existing customer base. So some customers you might lose some customers. Some customers might reduce activity, reduce users, reduce services. But the net effect of all of that, if it's above 100%, then it just means you don't have to win any new customers. You can just grow through upselling to existing customers. It's got a quarter of the market cap in cash, I think 34 million net cash. And it's on less than 3x revenue, but it's about on ARR, on annualized recurring revenue, it's about 3.5x. So it's still inexpensive.
It looks a great company, quality business that I wouldn't be surprised at. When you talk about sort of like your private equity look, that some private equity boys or software roll-ups or something like that would be very interesting. Now, in the same vein, we've got, and we've talked about this one before, ActiveOps, which does basically process automation sort of technology, largely for sort of like the financial sector, things like know your customer and all this sort of stuff. But it also does it for sort of like helping hybrid workforces, managing, getting it, improving the actual efficiencies. And they really seem to have also turned a corner by putting more AI into their portfolio stack. So another sort of benefit. What's your sort of latest on this one?
Yeah, we've talked about this before. And I mean, my latest is kind of, this just continues to deliver on the strategy. So, this is, again, it's similar to Diaceutics and Netcall. The end market's really attractive here. So it's an enterprise software business, SaaS business. It essentially is a kind of orchestration layer that manages your sort of workforce, has quite a bit in the sort of banking and financial services space as customers. So it will plug into your back office systems, your kind of capacity systems in terms of, people and inventory in terms of, people when they're working and how many days they have a holiday, that kind of thing. And it will basically help you optimize your capacity and inventory and help you sort of organize your workforce across disparate teams. And when you have a hybrid work environment, so that, COVID was a kind of a bit of a catalyst in terms of people are sort of doing a bit of sort of hybrid working, it's much more difficult to manage. And yeah, so this has just been, I don't know, I guess maybe we talk about this every time, but we've sort of been saying this is a great business in a really attractive marketplace with structural drivers where, you know, I wouldn't say the market's kind of finally woken up to how, you know, the opportunity here, but it's, you know, the shares have performed strongly and, you know, it looks like people are kind of starting to believe in the story a bit more. But it, yeah, it's, you know, it does double digit growth in ARR, gross margin of 84%. Again, the net revenue retention rate, 107%. Cash conversion is very high. They've got 18 million in net cash out of, I think it's about 95, 96 million market cap. So again, it trades at about 3.2 times ARR.
Mm.
So I think last time we spoke about it was about 2.5 times.
Yeah.
So it's, the shares have gone up a bit, although obviously the business has grown a bit. Still, it's still undervalued though. You know, this business is super high quality business. And again, it's just, you know, it's a great kind of compounder of profits and cash over time.
Yeah. Yeah, it does seem to have reached a real inflection point because it's now generating cash, having gone through an investment phase, and it's EBITDA profitable. There's no doubt about it. So yeah, and there's just anecdotally, I've actually spoken to a number of the fund managers offline, and they want to get in on an active op. So I think you're right. Even if there's a bit of sort of volatility, I've got a sneaky suspicion somebody's going to be picking up some any loose stock if there is a bit of sort of like a sell off. Now let's move to another one in the AI side, which is machine learning, which is a picks and shovels player. Hadn't really ever covered it. Decisys Group, which I think has now got a sort of a bit of a rock star exec chairman who's just been brought in. It's quite a much smaller business, about £30 million. Did a big fundraise, about £11 million it raised at 33p just recently, which just says that there's a lot of support behind this guy. I think he did a brilliant job with Scalper, but when he was a CEO there for 12 years. What's your sort of the thesis on this one? Because as I say, I think it's more of a picks and shovels AI play, helping other companies, isn't it, to really scale those up, digitization opportunities.
Yeah, this is, yes, it's not really a software business, this, but it is a, it's basically managed IT services. So, you know, cloud hosting, connectivity, cybersecurity as a managed support service, specifically caters to SMEs and mid-market corporates. It's not as sexy as Nvidia, if we're honest. But it's not as expensive as Nvidia. It's something like, I don't know, 5 times EBITDA or something. But there's huge demand there's a huge demand generally in terms of things like cloud migration and kind of hosting services, and, you know, particularly at the SME end and the sort of smaller end of the spectrum where, you know, it's kind of the business case to do so is not quite as clear cut, and these businesses have probably been operating with their own systems in-house, and then, you know, you've had the significant decrease in computing cost, and, you know, that's been quite a big enabler. So, you know, a lot of these businesses are, over the last few years, and now it's become quite economical and attractive to do, you know, cloud migration, some of these other connectivity services. So that, you know, that's been a kind of driver. But I think the other, you know, the AI driver here as well is that, related to that cloud compute cost coming down, but also the kind of proliferation of, you know, open source and other AI and machine learning algorithms that you can use to try and drive efficiencies within your business. Yeah, that is now, I guess, it's becoming more democratized outside of just the large corporates. And, you know, some of these sort of smaller companies, you know, they want to try to use some of these tools, but there's quite a high, you know, if you want to go and just put in a, you know, buy a load of GPUs in a data center and run, you know, ChatGPT, that's going to cost you a lot of money. So I guess what the CIS Group's trying to do is that, you know, as well as the core services they do, they're trying to help these businesses to basically rent some GPU space and, you know, trial some of the AI tools that they can use. And they've got, you know, they've got a team in-house who sort of specialize in this sort of kind of service and consultancy around AI. So they can, you know, it's a bit of kind of democratization of that sort of AI play in a way that's kind of enabling companies to be able to see if they can, you know, they can benefit from it. And it's sort of delivering that in quite an attractive way from a kind of rental and cost perspective. So there's not huge capex for these companies, which would just make it a complete, you know, kind of non-starter for them. So I think that, you know, that's a clear driver here. They did a big fundraising, which, you know, to be able to address some of these sort of end markets and customers, they need to sort of acquire some capability and broaden, you know, their offering. And that's exactly what they kind of raised the money for. As you said, like, the new exec chair came in, he invested a couple of million of his own money personally. He's executed a really successful kind of story in Scapa. So this looks really exciting, and it's really cheap. And there's, you know, plenty to go out in the market. So quite an exciting buy and build, I think, for Sys Group going forward.
Have you spoken to the new chairman? I guess you have, haven't the exec chairman?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay. He gets if he passes the Gresham, then he'll pass my test as well. So I'll take your word for it. If you,
I'd always encourage you to do your own DD, of course.
Okay.
Paul. Yeah, we have had numerous conversations with him.
Okay, good. Okay, well, let's move into, you've got similar sort of like picks and shovels in sort of the AI, but it's sort of the data center provider, which is IMR, which is really is sort of like been a real perennial sort of like, I wouldn't say disappointment, but the shares haven't gone anywhere for about 5 years. They keep getting sold off. I know you guys have been increasing position as the valuation has got far more attractive, but they should be in exactly the right place at the right time to sort of provide hosting and hybrid cloud services to small, medium-sized companies, right in the UK, but largely around the world, with their unique sort of data center proposition. But they've been struggling to get growth, organic growth, that is. They've got acquisition growth, but organic. What's your sort of your latest on this one? Because it should be doing a lot better in a really hot space.
Yeah. So I think our latest on this is probably unchanged versus last time. I think that this is still overlooked as a kind of valuation versus the quality of the business and the potential. It's 90% recurring revenue. So look, it has had challenges in the past from some customer churn, and there's been a bit of change at, you know, the corporate level. That's probably what's caused the sell-off. But this is, you know, 90% of revenue from cloud services, 90% is recurring. Yeah. This is kind of, again, similar to Sys Group. It's targeting customers who are underserved by those hyperscalers. So, you know, the kind of SMEs and, you know, smaller corporates or mid-sized corporates, you know, where there's not a, you know, where there's, they may want a hybrid cloud proposition. They may want private cloud. They may want some managed IT services as well. You know, where you're not a huge business, where you just go with an AWS and, you know, that's the most economical, or Azure, and that's the most economical thing you can do. And, you know, it's quite a straightforward decision. If not, it's not probably not straightforward implementation, but, you know, there's definitely a market that's underserved. And, you know, these guys have got the capability to be flexible and to provide, you know, slightly like not just off the shelf solutions, but kind of, you know, solutions that can fit for some of these smaller players. So I think that, you know, the market's underserved. There's also the cross-sell capability. So introducing things like cybersecurity as part of the managed IT services offering, which is, you know, again, very topical given things like CrowdStrike and, you know, the other, almost every week there's a, you know, sort of cybersecurity incident. So, you know, you've got a good quality of earnings base. You've got an underserved market. You've got structural drivers in terms of compute costs coming down, and the sort of, again, increase in democratization of this, you know, this type of thing. You've got cross-sell capability. You know, the shares, the single-digit EBITDA multiple, I think, probably 6x EBITDA, if that.
Yeah, I've got 11.5x PE ratio, which is a joke.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually lower than 6x, but then you probably have to look at the capex adjusted EBITDA. But it is against the M&A sector, the precedent transactions is massively undervalued. And I think, you know, people are, yeah, maybe slightly caught up with it's, you know, UK small cap stock, and there's been some noise historically. And, you know, we think that the trajectory is really positive there.
Good. And the management team's considering you're a big shareholder, you've obviously spoken to the management team. And is it Lucy Dimes? She's the new CEO. Well, she's been there for about 12 months. You're very happy with how the management team's sort of like progressing?
We are, yeah. Yeah, we have. We've been engaged in management discussions and board level discussions with the team. And yeah, happy with that.
Good. Okay, good. Let's switch sector. We've got a question coming from Steve Walters asking about TP ICAP, which is basically the world's largest interdealer broker. Got a bit of a unbundling opportunity with its OTC, over-the-counter, they do commodities and interest rates and stuff like that, sort of products division, data division called Parameta, which could potentially be sort of unbundled. But their share prices have started to improve over the last 2 or 3 years, and they did get through the volatility without any of their clients seemingly having problems. But top level, I did actually notice that David Solomon of Goldman Sachs was saying that trading revenues in August for Goldman, surprisingly, had been a bit softer. So what's your latest on TP ICAP? Because it's still not expensive. It's about 8.5 times PE.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think, look, TP ICAP, it's a really, really interesting situation. So basically, as you said, you've got the sort of largest sort of interdealer broker in the market. And, you know, this is so it's quite interesting. The volatility, you know, they benefit from volatility. When you had interest rates that weren't moving at all, people weren't doing, you know, customers weren't really doing much in terms of trading and swaps and such like. And as soon as you started to see a change in that, you know, so you've seen a change in interest rate environment, it's a huge movements in energy prices and commodity prices and all of that, you know, has been a positive for this business. Increased activity, increased revenues and profits from that. That's not really part of our investment case here. So, you know, this for that part of the business, it's been always been a kind of people voice driven market, and essentially there's a huge opportunity to electronify that. And you know, there's an opportunity in terms of driving cost efficiencies, but also in terms of aggregating products onto a single kind of dashboard and platform that allows brokers to see what clients are looking at certain products or where there might be cross-sell opportunities. It allows execution of those products in a much more timely and efficient way. It has sort of straight through processing into back office settlement again. So, you know, there's a kind of increase in productivity in terms of bringing some digitization to the sort of, you know, the dealer end of the market, and there's a cost efficiency from that as well, because you take out some manual processes and you know, put some technology and automation in instead. So, you know, we sort of see, you know, the market backdrop for them is it changes a bit, but it's quite diversified. They've got, you know, they've got rates exposure, energy and commodities exposure, you know, so they've got a few different areas. They've got equities exposure through Liquidnet. The other thing is that Liquidnet had then been been in the worst market that they'd ever seen in terms of sort of block trades and equity market, but they've got that to a break-even position. That's now started to improve, so that's contributing to profit. The whole business trades at about 4 times EBITDA. It's got positive net cash. It pays something like a 7 or 8% dividend yield, which is only 50% payout ratio. And the other bit that's really exciting that you mentioned was that they've got, within this business, they've got a proprietary data business that takes all, you know, all of the data they've got from these over-the-counter trades and, in anything from straightforward products through to quite niche and exotic products, takes all of that data and repackages it and sells it to people like Bloomberg and Thomson Reuters, and that business parameter, it's making almost 200 million of revenue at 40% EBIT margin. So it's gonna, I think it's gonna make 80 million. It's gonna make at least 80 million EBIT, I think, based on H1 results. And you know, the market cap of, I mean, the market cap, I think when we last spoke about this, the market cap was maybe about a billion. So you could basically, you could not believe in anything else apart from the data business to justify holding it. It's higher than, I think it's maybe 1.7 or 1.8 billion.
That's correct.
Market cap now. But yeah, that's a high quality, high margin data business. They have done a sort of reorganization to make it a kind of unique entity. So, and they are, I think it's, they announced in the results that they're exploring potential options with what they do with that, which as a potential option that includes a listing of that business. So I think there's, you know, a potential kind of value realization opportunity ahead, but you know, 8% yield, 4x EBITDA, you know, that's kind of, that's pretty attractive, I would say.
Yeah, it looks like deep value to me, that's for sure, even though the shares have done very well, what, sort of 50%. Another one in the same sort of vein of the great sort of in capital markets with a good sort of like opportunity to digitize a lot of their activities are Gentex, which has been, unfortunately, gone through a few trials and tribulations of its own of late. It's had a new management team in who seems super hungry to make a success of it, and their strategy is to move away from white glove foreign exchange sort of dealing, et cetera, and running forward contracts into combining that with a alternative banking solution, which is straight through processing mass payments around the world, et cetera, and also overseas grocery. What's your sort of your latest on this? Because the shares are really on the floor and at distress sort of levels, even though the balance sheet seems fine because they did a recent placing, I think, at 45p.
Yeah, look, this is... it's been through quite a bit of change, as you say, in terms of management change, sort of rebasing of forecasts and kind of strategic shift towards alternative banking platform. I think the business, as you say, it had, you know, there's this kind of latent level of, it's got a great kind of reputation and name in the space in terms of corporate, you know, corporate services, FX services for corporates. And, you know, they generated, I guess, 40 to 50 million of revenue from that. That can be a bit variable depending on appetite, depending on, you know, the macro backdrop in terms of willingness and kind of urgency of customers to need to do that, those hedging transactions. So, you know, I think they've gone down the route of diversifying away from that into some higher quality of earnings business and really leveraging the platform and the investment that's been made into that platform to date. So, you know, they have the opportunity to essentially provide kind of alternative banking services to, you know, to institutions where, you know, you can effectively operate a kind of, you can sell a virtual IBAN, you can do, you know, a range of services, mass payment services, through to holding, you know, holding deposits and earning interest on deposits, and you know, a whole host of other things that some of these kind of institutions, which might be sort of alternative asset managers or financial institutions, you know, where they might have a more kind of complex need for these types of services versus, you know, the likes of your standard corporate, and where those needs are kind of, they're more predictable. You can sort of feel the customer heartbeat, but more you can see, depending on, you know, if it's a fund or an asset manager, you can see typical kind of fund cycles or typical payment, you know, sort of payment patterns that they might need to match up against. So, you know, that I think is a huge opportunity for them. The quality of earnings should improve significantly. The margin should improve significantly as well, because those services are much higher margin. And, you know, there's a bit of investment to make into that. But, yeah, this is a kind of a business with kind of reasonable scale already. And, you know, things like the compliance department and the kind of regulatory setup that they've got is kind of fit for purpose to be able to do these services, and not really offering them at the moment. So I think that's the opportunity there. And you know, the shares, they, you know, they've got a lot of cash, you know, that they've got available to execute this, plus they've got, you know, cash as collateral, plus they've got some free cash as well. So it's well capitalized, this business. And you know, the valuation that is sort of trading on this site is ridiculous. It's
Yeah.
Assuming that it's going to go out of business and fail. So I think, I don't think it's going to be an overnight kind of execution, but, you know, on a sort of 2 to 3 year view, I think this is a really exciting business, and there's quite a big sort of profit uplift that you can see here.
Yeah, there just seems to be quite a lot of skepticism in the share price at the moment. I mean, the actual estimates going forward do seem quite achievable, to say the least, in terms of probably being kitchen sink so they can get over the bar, etc. But in terms of the strategy, seems to be absolutely spot on in terms of adding on services, the automatic payments that work, and we know them from other competitors. They generate a lot of growth and a lot of cash and good margins, and it's scalable and all that kind of stuff. So the strategy is tick, 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 absolutely works. It comes down to speed of execution, because the market's not, you know, it didn't stay still. What's your sort of level of confidence in catching up with the competition in the timescales needed to get to where they're aiming to be?
Yeah, look, it's all about execution from here, and that's why the shares are where they're at. You know, the market, this is a small cap business where the market sentiment's not going to give you credit until you start executing. So it's all about that. And I think, so it comes down to, I think in terms of the competitor set, you know, there are some competitors that are doing this, but it's not, you know, Alpha Group would be the main one who is, you know, who's doing this very well. But outside of them, they're, you know, this is still a market that is enormous in terms of size and potential, but where, you know, the story here has been the kind of shift in share from, you know, 85% being done by banks and big brokers to sort of rising the kind of independence. And so I think, you know, outside of the likes of Alpha and perhaps some others that are doing this or trying to do this, you know, you still got the incumbents of the slow moving, not very flexible, getting a bit better at being kind of technology enabled, but still quite poor at that. So I don't think that, I think it's more around that, you know, the having the right team in place to execute on it than, you know, then in a year's time, is the window going to have closed? I don't think the window is going to have closed in that shorter period of time. And I think they've got a new team on board who are very capable and, you know, who we think can actually execute this, you know, execute this sort of shift into that market. So I think that they're well set up to do it, but, you know, we'll have to see because these things are never straightforward. There's always bumps in the road. But it's mispriced, you know, the price that it's on is too big a discount.
Yeah. Well, as I say, I've spoken to the CEO, and I'm sure you have, and he's super hungry, and the management team is. If it can be achieved in the timescales, then I'd be backing those guys to do it. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's move sectors. We've got let's go to Franchise Brands, which is a B2B services business that as its title says, it buys sort of like franchisees or Swiss franchisers around the world. So it's got a It bought a filter which does oil cleaning a few years ago off the off the listed market. It also added Pertec, which is a sort of like flexible hoses business that does emergency sort of drainage services, and also got a water and stormwater type business, I think, in the UK. Big, very all good growth platforms going forward. What's your latest on this? Because it is run by a sort of another real rock star, Stephen Hemsey, I think, is the CEO or chairman.
Yeah, rock star in the franchise business space for sure. So look, we had been investors in Filter and Franchise Brands, and then those two merged, and then they acquired Pertec. And you know, I think so. Looking at the business now versus what it was a number of years ago, you know, this is a business which is it's just much bigger in terms of scale, but it's much more diversified, and it's got a much larger opportunity to grow profits going forward. So I think, you know, through acquisition, firstly, the team you've got, as you say, you've got a great team in place who know how to run a franchise business. Look at the success that we've seen with Domino's. This is now operationally and geographically diverse. So they're in something like over 10 countries, and they've got a number of different brands, and they've got, you know, hundreds of franchisees. So, you know, the kind of quality spread across in terms of earnings across across the business is much better. The, you know, originally this business had a few B2C brands, but this is now kind of B2B focused business. And those, you know, those you know, something like Pertec, as an example, is, you know, it's there are some corporate owned elements, but it's mostly franchise system sales that they're getting management services revenue or management service fee from. So I think that we look at the business now, you've got a business that's sort of 9 to 10 times EBITDA, which for a business of that scale, franchise business with high quality revenues, is too cheap. Even if you just think that the business right now is running great and it's not going to, you know, there's no other upside, it's just going to grow as, you know, from kind of as their end markets grow and they have customer growth, then it's still too cheap. But I think there are some very, very idiosyncratic drivers within the business that are going to accelerate that growth. So you've got, you've got deleveraging. So they took on a fair amount of debt and they acquired Pertec, but you've got the cash generations coming through to deleverage now, which is going to improve your earnings growth. You've got, you know, quite a bit of kind of professionalization that they've done, so that, you know, they bought a number of businesses, you know, probably too many for us to talk about, but you know, all those businesses were being run not in as efficient way as they're being run now, you know, so centralizing things like the, you know, the operational logistics for, you know, how you go and do certain visits to customers, or centralizing your kind of CRM and marketing systems. There's probably been also quite a lot of synergies that have come out generally just from, you know, kind of using technology. You know, as an example, I think the business model for Pertec was, you know, there was an element of a kind of markup on materials rather than a management service fee. And so just adopting a management service fee across the whole organization is, you know, that's quite transformational. So there's been some, you know, quite a bit of sort of professionalizing and centralizing of systems, kind of operating model to building in, you know, kind of standard and consistent operating model. They've been within those divisions, they've been expanding services. So in the kind of Pertec division, you know, there's opportunity to add different kind of hydraulic hose services to current customers. There's then some cross-sell potential across the business. And then there's also there's a kind of the maturity profile within some of the earlier stage markets, where, you know, so they've got certain geographies where corporate owned, which are very early in terms of maturity. And so as those mature, that's going to add additional growth. And, you know, there might be an opportunity to, you know, whether to sort of shift to franchise or, you know, to expand those in another way. So I think, you know, you've got quite a few levers there driving the earnings growth. And as I say, 9 to 10 times EBITDA, when you think the EBITDA figures, you know, it's going to be growing strongly double digit, you know, I think it's a pretty exciting opportunity, really.
Yeah, and once they've now reached that critical mass, that scale, the cross-fertilization of best practice across the leading franchises, across the other, you know, around that whole group, then that will just, you know, improve margins and performance for the franchisees, and then obviously by the franchisor, which is franchise band. So,
you also get, I mean, you get quite a lot of economies of scale from fairly obvious things, but from marketing, you get big economy. If you look at something like Domino's, where, you know, because you have a certain marketing budget and you can, the more customers you have, the more franchisees you have, you can allocate it across, you know, a wider number of sort of end users. And so you can leverage that kind of scale. And, you know, that's something that Domino's have done well versus their, you know, as they expand in terms of sites and customers and their competitors shrink, their marketing budget gives them, you know, that's a key differentiator. They can just, they can put more money into marketing, they can win more customers. It becomes a bit of a virtuous circle. So I think that, you know, that's potential here as well.
Yeah, and they're in the right growth areas. I mean, the water sort of, like, you know, preservation and treatment and drainage and all this sort of stuff. I mean, with climate change, I mean, how many storms and floods that we've had in the UK, and then likewise we've had problems about, you know, conserving water out in the States and in Southern Europe. So yeah, they're in the right.
They might have to launch a B2C offering and come around to my house and sort all the dust.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, let's switch sectors to sort of industrials, but automation again. We've got MPAC Group, which basically does high speed automation and packaging machines across food and beverage, healthcare sector, and also sort of clean energy, which is EV batteries. And I know you've recently purchased. They've got, again, and this is, I guess, is a bit of a theme, I guess, of your sort of stock picking. You look for the right management team because they've got a pretty sort of like rock star CEO here who's really sort of rolling up his sleeves to grow this business. But again, the shares have done well of late.
Yeah. Yeah, this is it's an exciting opportunity, this one. So it's as you said, it supplies sort of packaging automation machinery into the F&B, so food and beverage sector and healthcare sectors. So anything from helping companies sort of package contact lenses through to ice creams. The story here is basically you've got a market backdrop which is really, really supportive for this business. And the market is really fragmented in terms of companies, but you've got a shrinking labor force. So the working age population is shrinking and set to decline over time. I don't need to sort of tell everyone the kind of rising, wage inflation, national living wage pressure that we've seen on production companies and manufacturing businesses and consumer businesses. So, that's a huge structural driver here. You've then also got, a bit of kind of nearshoring and reducing reliance on kind of China and the Far East as being really big drivers for companies to adopt more automated kind of machinery in their production facilities, in their manufacturing facilities. So that, I think the structural backdrop is really attractive. The sectors this company plays into are, again, as you say, they are, they're not kind of dying sectors. They're sectors that are seeing kind of secular growth. They've got great customer base. So they've got, Mars, Nestle, Amazon, Diageo, like big blue chip customers. But I think, one of the exciting things here is that about 70% of their business is from the sale of machinery, which is lower margins, at about 25% gross margin. 30% is from the kind of aftermarket support on kind of services, maintenance, parts. That's about 45% margin. And these machines have got very long shelf life. So they're typically, there's an over a 20-year kind of shelf life. So as this business grows, the installed base, you're going to see a shift in terms of that proportion of revenue towards the higher margin, higher quality of earnings. Stream over time, and so that we think is a strong driver of obviously earnings. Earnings is going to grow as margins go up, but also the quality of earnings should improve the rating. This trades at a single digit EBITDA multiple discount to Preston acquisitions. There's a lot of sort of private equity interest in this space. I think there's a Aries backed roll up of a bunch of kind of platform roll up in this space. And I think Syntagon was another acquisition or divestment by Bosch, I think. But there's quite a big there's quite a big sort of PE interest in this area as well. So I think that's good long term earnings drivers. And maybe there's some M&A activity that we see across the space.
Yeah, and I think the other one is basically as the cost of implementing the robotics and automation has fallen significantly, and the ease of implementing it, we're reaching an inflection point that in many instances now it's actually much cheaper to build a fully automated facility which can run you haven't got to have shifts, patterns, you can run them when you want to in terms of speed and what products and stuff like that. It's now cheaper to do that on a per unit basis than it is to keep it offshore into sort of like Asia, because the cost of labor out in Asia is increasing and is not as nowhere near as flexible. So you've got that. It has reached a point whereby it's becoming cost efficient to fully automate even over above low cost countries like in China and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, let's move to another stock. Let's go to financial services. We've got Fintel, and I know we've talked about this, another very, very high-quality company that's done really well for you. It supplies a lot of data to IFAs and to investors in terms of which products are you sort of like which funds and which insurance and mortgages and stuff like this. I mean, it hasn't really put a foot wrong. Bit of a buy and build strategy, good gross margin. What's your latest on this? Is this really just keep run your winners, is it, I guess? But
yeah, look, this is sort of progressing in terms of the, I think last time we spoke about it, you know, it's kind of, it has historically been evolving from an outsourced kind of compliance service provider to two-sided digital technology and data platform. And
yeah,
you know, that has really continued. The execution has been really good. The new chair joined last year, who is very high quality, and you know we've seen they've done a bit of a buy and build in terms of, so they've got on one side they've got the kind of you know the proposition to IFAs around, you know, that is used to be kind of just outsourced compliance services, but it's sort of expanded into, you know, other kind of software elements, you know, so they've done that through some acquisitions. Which has obviously increased the sort of SaaS and subscription revenue. So it's about 2/3, I think, recurring out of the total, which is great. And then the other side that you alluded to was through the kind of de facto acquisition, which you know, essentially gathers, you know, they have a team who gather lots of different data points on various products, and that can be anything from, you know, fund ratings from some of our funds through to an insurance product or, you know, a banking product by NatWest, for example. So thousands of products. There's a huge benefit of the kind of network effect, which increases relevance from doing, you know, some of the IFAs used de facto for, you know, some of the fund ratings. And so, you know, this is sort of benefiting from that network effect. The structural drivers here again are really strong in terms of, you know, IFAs are outsourced. Yeah. The growth in outsourcing non-revenue generating sources continues to be a driver there. I would say, look, this has just continued to increase, just continued to grow strongly. Targeted acquisitions have broadened the proposition. Network effect is creating a positive kind of virtuous circle, positive feedback loop for them. Earnings quality is going up. You know, this is a kind of cash generative business, and it trades at a discount to, you know, it's not expensive what it is, and it trades at a discount to pressing acquisitions as well. So I just think it's, you know, high quality business with plenty more growth and probably a bit of a re-rating to come as well.
When you look at the sort of the chart to sort of like glean whether it is high quality, even when you have that volatility, the shares don't budge, and the 200-day keeps rising, which just says that there's people quality, you know, these professional investors there looking to accumulate because it's such a really high class business. Okay, it's just a remark.
Yeah. Well, there's a bit of concentration in the shareholder base as well, probably.
Okay, fine. Okay, good. Remind anybody wants to ask a question for Brendan, then I'll put it there. We got another one from Steve Walters asking about moneysupermarket.com, which is basically obviously did really well in the cost of living crisis, helping customers choose sort of like its financial products, whether it's insurance, whether it's travel, you know, travel or cash or any type of products. But now also we've got the energy market starting to open up, and the last time I saw it actually the shares had sort of ticked down a bit, but what's your latest on Money Supermarket?
This business is every time we talk about it there's one part of the business that is performing really well and there's some parts that are not, and so
yeah,
and they're always different. So this is a sort of oligopoly type market. Big barriers to entry. They've got a very strong market position, and it's, you know, that all of that underpins the high profit margin and cash generation potential here. So I think that this is it's a sort of leader in a space where it's a bit of a kind of cash cow. I think that they've got great diversification across product and market. So, you know, travel during COVID, there was nothing from travel that has come out and been, you know, formed strongly. And then, you know, we saw as the interest rates changed, we suddenly saw, you know, kind of people looking, you know, using things like Money Saving Expert for, you know, credit cards and banking, you know, various banking products. So that, you know, has been positive. And then, you know, the energy has been, you know, that's been a zero for a long time. But then, you know, that could be something that contributes quite strongly as well. So I think the diversification is really is great, and it underpins that kind of quality of earnings. All of that means that you've got a decent dividend yield, and you've got some ongoing kind of earnings growth, and you know, some great cash generation, and it's a very robust business that it should compound well over the long term. But I think the bit that's quite exciting and probably more interesting from a kind of growthy perspective is the opportunity that we see from the kind of re-platformization, if that is a word, it's probably not, of their business. So they've got, you know, because they had done a few acquisitions, and they've got, you know, their customer data is, or historically has probably not been as well connected as it could have been. And by the way, this is something that we've seen right across the kind of e-commerce space, is that particularly with third-party cookie consents changing, the need to be all over how you access your customer data in a way that's really efficient, and so you can track that customer journey. This is just becoming such a big, you know, such a key thing for customers. So they've gone through an exercise of kind of slightly re-architecting the platform. And, you know, this is a big win for them, because if they can enrich their data and track all their, you know, get all the data for customers and connect it across different products, rather than holding, you know, if you go and buy a travel insurance policy, and they might hold your data in one silo, and then if you go and buy car insurance, then, you know, you might put in some slightly different data, but they're like, you know, maybe they don't connect it, and they don't work out that actually it's the same Paul Hill. And, you know, so then they can't target you in a more effective way. And they have to then, if they want to reacquire you as a customer, they might have to do more on Google Ads and increase their customer acquisition costs. So by having like a centralized enterprise data layer, and then spinning up different applications from that, and having all of your product offerings based on that, you have one single view of your customer. So they'll know, okay, Paul Hill has got these different products, this is where he's bought, this is how he's interacted with the website, connect it all together. When they go to reacquire you as a customer, they kind of know, well, we don't need to pay for something to be sponsored at the top of his Google page, because we've got an easier way of targeting him. And so this sort of digitization piece is, you know, it's well underway, and it should deliver quite material improvements in the acquisition cost of customers versus lifetime value, and therefore improve the margins. So we think that is, we haven't seen the benefits of that yet, but we think that is going to be a key driver going forward.
Is there any danger from generative AI with sort of like internet discovery on it, i.e. such that rather than Money Supermarket suggesting or giving a list of, you know, preferred sort of like insurance rates and travel insurance and all this sort of stuff, but essentially, you know, you've got Gemini or you've got ChatGPT searching and then coming up with one shop for you?
I think there's always a risk of that. Just take all our jobs, Paul. We'll be left.
not yours, mine, definitely. Mine was sort of disappeared with Max Headroom back in the 80s, I think, from MTV.
Amazon made an announcement that they were going to try and enter the space, and the shares fell quite a lot, but then they sort of recovered. It's, you know, it's kind of not as straightforward as you might think. And I think that I'm sure there is a risk of that AI come and, you know, you can try and do this in a, you know, using ChatGPT or something in a certain way, but I would say that that's probably for something like Money Supermarket, you know, that's an opportunity for them really to be using, you know, that. So there's an opportunity for them to try and use AI in the most efficient way, to the extent they don't do it at the moment in terms of selecting insurance policies and, you know, trying to be more kind of, I don't know, kind of more on the front foot when it comes to serving customers. So I think it's probably, it's much easier for them to implement that rather than, you know, someone to build a kind of generative AI proposition that completely, you know, takes out Money Supermarket's market position, because ultimately, you know, it's a brand that's been in this space for a long time. People know it, you know, you've got that brand law. Even if you have an AI proposition, you can do the same thing. You still got to go and acquire customers. You still got, you know, that brand and that marketing spend, which is a huge barrier to entry. So yeah, possibly, but I think it will be on a quite a long time horizon, I would say. And I think the way that Money Supermarket approached their sort of tech spend and the R&D investment, they're very much kind of thinking about these kind of things, and that's sort of underpinned the digitization piece that they're doing.
Yeah, no, I would agree. It's work in progress, isn't it? That kind of thing. Nobody knows who's going to be the winners and losers. Okay, let's just go to the final one. We've got Ricardo, which is an engineering consultancy, which has shifted totally, transformed over the last few years into environmental sort of consultancy services to help, obviously, you know, climate change and all this sort of stuff. Historically, it used to be in sort of like, you know, automotive. What's your sort of latest on this? Because it just had its results, I think, yesterday. What's your latest view?
Yeah, so this is a business that it trades on like 6 or 7 times EBITDA because it is a business in transition. It's a business that used to make, you know, used to be mostly a kind of internal combustion engine type business. Yeah. So there were, you know, perception around declining market. It's a business that's completely repivoted to now being focused on kind of consultancy services around environmental and energy transition, around kind of rail infrastructure and how that again feeds into some of these long-term structural drivers. And then around, you know, within automotive and industrial, around kind of emerging technology. So, you know, how do you implement, how do you engineer and design marine vessels to be, you know, not just burn diesel to, you know, maybe be more efficient from a fuel perspective, or, you know, more environmentally friendly, or use hydrogen fuel cells or whatever it is. So the strategy to focus on, to shift towards those areas, is absolutely the right strategy. You know, you've got a business now that has very, very long-term structural drivers to support the buying of those services. You've got a really specialist capability in terms of what they do, like really value add engineering and design services, strategic consultancy, very technical consultancy components. You've got an element of software that they use in house to augment their proposition, which is good for margins, but also good for the end customer. You've got a sort of shift from, you know, kind of more capital intensive type of business when you're being a bit more of a kind of engineering and manufacturing business to being capital light, very high return on capital employed. Higher margins. If you look at the E&E business, that's sort of 17-18% operating margin. So from an investment point of view, you've got the business which is, you know, it's expanded, growth is improving, capital intensity is reducing, margins are improving, obviously overall profits are therefore improving as well, quality of earnings is improving. So, you know, this is And alongside that, the business has got a strategy to actually double the profit over, I think, by 2027. So, you know, this is not the finished product. So it's not there yet. There's, you know, there are certain moving parts within some of those end markets. So, at, you know, the way that customers might be sort of purchasing engineering and design consultancy for, you know, some emerging technologies within automotive can change depending on certain factors in the organization and other circumstances. So there's, you know, some elements are a bit lumpier than others, but there's a bit of an offsetting and nature and there's a bit of diversification. But I think this is one that you kind of, if you look forward 2 to 3 years and you've got a business that's got double the profit, it's trading at the moment on 7x EBITDA, but that that profit is going to be inherently higher margin, higher quality, more repeatable in nature. And then if you look at what some of the acquisition multiples for, you know, that you see in the space for some of those businesses, or, you know, RPS as an example, which, you know, is probably the margins that Ricardo will generate will be the step change ahead of the margins of that business. And the kind of value add, you know, the proposition is probably a lot stronger in terms of customer value proposition. And that, I think that was bought for about 18 to 19 times EBIT or EBITDA and 27 times PE. And, you know, we've seen, you know, there's been private transactions in the kind of environmental consultancy space. They're not being done at 7x EBITDA. They're being done at probably twice that. So, you know, that, so if you put together the earnings growth and the re-rating, you know, even if you don't get to 14x EBITDA, this is, yeah, this is kind of a 3x from here in our view. So there's a huge upside here. There's, you know, there's, as we talked about with Argentics, there's execution risk for sure, but you've got a team in there who are really good and who are really capable, who are delivering on this kind of pivot. It's not that straightforward, but there's been a huge amount of work that they've done in terms of reorganization of the overall business and cost efficiency. And, you know, so I think this is a really exciting one to watch. And as you start to see the business become a bit cleaner, you know, I think there's probably some parts of the business that don't quite fit with the, you know, the sort of vision going forward. So as that becomes cleaner, you know, I think the market might wake up to it and think, okay, this is a, you know, proper kind of environmental consultancy business, should be rated a high multiple. Yeah, so I think it's a really exciting one.
Yeah, time to be patient. In fact, as an indication of the excellence in this business, I remember in my boy racer days, I think they designed the Cosworth, the Ford Cosworth engine, which was like industry leading at the time. You could put your foot down and you take it off at like a SpaceX on that one. So yeah, it was a high performance engine. Okay, brilliant. We've gone through some fabulous stocks there, Brendan, and many thanks for all those comments and stuff like that. If somebody wants to put some money into your funds and stuff, I guess they just go to the normal platforms, like probably like there's ones with Fintel and stuff like that, all the information.
Yeah, I think they're on pretty much all of the platforms. Or just you can call someone in our sales team and they'll help you. But yeah, they're all on platform, I think.
Brilliant. Okay, great. Well, thanks again for your time. And I hope you're well. I think you're right in terms of all of the, you know, the positivity for small caps, but just got to be patient, haven't you, in this market. But look forward anyway and chatting in about 6 months' time.
No worries. Thanks very much, Paul.
Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.